is knowing.
All right, Matt, welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 623. Jason Lindgren is with me, and we are going to cover the surveillance state. And even in just the last, I don't know, handful of years, the surveillance in even smaller parts of the country is just ratcheting up. I'm in a tiny state, Rhode Island, and there are parts of it that are very rural. And nonetheless, we see the infrastructure coming in, the cameras, the hidden antennas, and everything else that goes with it. And that sets aside that anybody carrying a phone can be triangulated within a foot, probably, or less, of where their actual location is. And that's just the very surface of it. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a rainy good morning.
So you put together a lot of notes here around this topic. Do you want to add anything in before we jump?
Oh, boy. This is a very, very heavy topic. There's so much to it. And like I always say, of course, I had to leave things out. And we'll see just how crazy things are by the time we get to the end.
I don't think most people realize, and I can never remember the published date of Shoshana Zuboff's book, Surveillance Capitalism.
2019, I believe.
Yeah, I always think 16 for some reason, but it's always later than I remember. I don't know why that is. But if we go back to 2019 and look at that book, most people won't because it's so big, but they have no idea where the state of things was then. And you've got to realize to put a book like that together is going to require years of research. Just to edit a book of that size, probably going to take a year or two, I'm guessing. My point is that the surveillance state and the capitalism that is based on surveillance is here and has been here and being built out quickly. Anyhow, Jason, let's do this.
The surveillance state is a governing system or societal condition in which a centralized authority, typically a governing state, but sometimes in collaboration with private entities, will systematically monitor, collect, and analyze information about individuals or groups, often without their explicit consent, to maintain security, enforce compliance, or exert influence. This could be enabled by technology and might be justified by an appeal for order or safety. It prioritizes data accumulation and behavioral prediction over individual privacy and would embed surveillance into the fabric of daily life. Needless to say, this has happened many times before in many places throughout history to one degree or another.
Just probably not at the levels we're aware of. You know, we don't really know old history. As a matter of fact, we don't know history within a couple hundred years very accurately, probably. But as we go through this, every time you hear Jason use the past tense, you can easily shift that in your mind to the present tense. One of the main reasons the digital world is being built is so that the people who want their one world order can control everything. And to control everything, they need to claim ownership of the systems that are going to control it. And they have done that with the digital world. So basically, the foundational reason for the digital world is to digitize or control with digitized instruments everything. And we're there now.
Going way back into prehistory, the earliest form of some sort of surveillance state could be thought of as the members of the community itself. Because there was no governmental structure in the modern sense, members of a community would be keeping tabs on each other for any troublemakers. Obviously, this sort of thing still goes on today, and it's just as effective now as it was thousands of years ago.
I would say more so, Jason, because the state of people's minds right now, we've been dumbed down for decades. Our food is in the toilet. We have examples. People to this day talk about the brown shirts of Nazi Germany and say, how could that have happened? But very few people recall the cultural spring or whatever they call it in China, where they use the children to become the enforcement mechanism. And this kind of thing still goes on today in lesser versions, where you see even during COVID, where a common citizen is ratting out another person next to them. And this is one of the mechanisms that's a stopgap that probably won't be required when technology is openly admitted to its full robustness.
I have heard many people comment and seen many people comment and thought about it myself. How could things have gotten the way they did in Nazi Germany? And then the COVID situation happened. And now it's happening again in a slightly different way with all of this Tesla nonsense.
It's hard to imagine how easily people are manipulated. And I noticed on HBO, I saw a listing for, what is it? Is it the Stanford experiment? I always forget the name of this too. It's the one where they have a person doling out electric shocks, and it's not real, but they think it's real. And if you go back and review it, do you know the name of it, Jason? Is it the Stanford experiment or something like that?
What you're referencing is the Milgram's experiment, which took place at Yale University.
Okay, there it is. But if you go back and review this, and of course, Hollywood is having its way with it now. They've created a version of that that they want you to see. What it basically shows is the people who did the experiment couldn't believe what they had predicted is some smaller number of people would go the distance and be administering basically deadly shocks when damn near 100% of them had done this. And this is a problem. And to me, what this points out is the homogenizing of culture through social engineering. This is the removal of the individual. And by removing the individual, individuals' decisions are not made. And there are other experiments that have been put on the table that show a very similar thing. One that comes to mind is they line up five or six people and only one of them is being tested. All the others are ringers. And what they do is they're shown pictures like which line is equal. And at some point, all the ringers begin to give the wrong answer. And even though it is painfully obvious they are giving the wrong answer, the person being tested is swayed by what the crowd does. And I'm going to say a very important thing here. Of all the research I've done on topics like this, it is crystal clear to me that social engineering is aimed at the crowd, the mindless beast. And that's what our news does. It's what politics does. And that tells you something very important about how critical it is to be an individual. Critically, critically important.
In the old kingdom of Egypt, circa 2686 through 2182 BCE, the pharaoh was the ruler of all there was in ancient Egypt. There is evidence that the pharaoh's kingdom was kept under scrutiny, since there was a large bureaucracy that existed even this far back in history, and it needed to be kept track of. To help keep track of all things Egyptian, there existed the office of the vizier. He would oversee the agriculture, labor projects, and the treasury. Scribes would be reporting grain yields, taxes collected, and worker quotas to him. He was also the top judge of the land and would hear disputes from all over the kingdom. And his word was the final judgment unless the pharaoh wanted to step in. The vizier managed what were known as the medjay, which could be described as a nomadic police force of sorts, which helped keep things in the kingdom stable on many levels. Depending on the era, the vizier sat in either Memphis or Thebes, with regional governors feeding him information.
We could go six ways to Sunday on this. People don't forget we have a Memphis in this country, which is being used by the current administration or the hangers-on to that administration. But I once saw, I don't remember who it was, but they said a critically important thing. Whenever you look at power structures, such as the one we're talking about, if you track it to the top, you're going to find a priest. And I think that's an important thing to remember, a very important thing to remember.
The sort of system that existed in ancient Egypt was seen in nearly every culture and civilization for thousands of years. With that being said, let's jump up to the time around the founding of the colonies in America and the American Revolution era itself. The British Crown was, of course, the power over the American colonies, and they maintained a surveillance apparatus that was aimed at controlling them by enforcing laws and suppressing rebellion. This system was decentralized and was reliant on local officials, with the situation intensifying as tensions escalated toward the coming revolution. Royal governors, who would be appointed by the crown, acted as the primary overseers of colonial activity. They monitored trade, tax compliance, and political sentiment, and would report what was going on back to London. Customs officials, such as those who enforced the Navigation Acts, tracked shipping and smuggling. The British Colonial Postal Service, which was established in 1691 and was formalized under Benjamin Franklin as Postmaster General, who held the position from 1753 to 1754, was considered a key tool. Postmasters, who were loyal to the crown, routinely opened and inspected the mail passing through their hands to detect seditious correspondence, especially after the 1689 English Bill of Rights had failed to curb such practices. Local elites and merchants loyal to Britain would serve as informal spies and report on community attitudes. In port cities like Boston and New York, tavern owners and dock workers would also often be useful informants. The Stamp Act of 1765 required tax stamps on legal documents and printed materials, which necessitated official oversight. This sparked widespread protests. After many riots, British troops were stationed in Boston in 1768, who were tasked with watching Patriot leaders like Samuel Adams and John Hancock. Soldiers reported on mob activity and intercepted messages whenever possible.
You know, there's even modern movies that show versions of this. The one with Mel Gibson, where the British are trying to take over the country, it shows some of the people who were made the aristocracy, given lands, titles, being paid off. But the only reason I bring this up is how hard do you suppose it would be in times like now, where so many people are broke, to wave 50 grand in front of someone to get them to do something? It seems like the conditions we're experiencing now would foster such efforts.
Plenty of examples like this occurred during the years of the American Revolution. Moving up to the year 1790, the United States of America is now its own country, and the young nation is taking its first steps toward understanding who lives within its borders with a census. The U.S. Constitution, which had been ratified just a few years earlier in 1788, mandated this count in Article 1, Section 2, requiring a headcount every 10 years to apportion congressional representation and taxes among the states. On August 2, 1790, federal marshals began this rather monumental task, fanning out across the 13 states, as well as the territories that would later become Kentucky, Maine, Tennessee, and Vermont. Although it was a rudimentary effort by today's standards, with no bureaucracy or forms mailed out, it still got done, with marshals knocking on doors or riding on horseback to tally up the existing population, although things were recorded in a much simpler way than they are today. It was a bare-bones system that was designed for practicality. Figure out how many people each state had for Congress and taxation, and get a rough sense of military-age men. Regardless, it was the start of the U.S. government systematically accounting for its population, which set the stage for the more detailed censuses and broader data collection that would come later.
Very few people probably consider how the census separates us from spiritual life. Jason and I have covered this in many law episodes. I want to say it's 1913, something like that. But one of the things that happened almost immediately is prior to the Census Bureau, you presented your family Bible to prove someone had been born. There's the connection to the spiritual life. Now, it doesn't matter what you think of Christianity or anything else. There is a moral code that goes with any spiritual endeavor, and that's what's being cleaved away from. But we have examples. I mean, the Bible, isn't Jesus moving around in one of the stories at a time of census? Rome's doing census back in the day. So in our country, when the census began, it is a hell of a milestone showing the change that is going to rapidly begin to occur. And again, one of the first symptoms of that is separating a tradition of writing family members' names into a holy book, which prescribes the morality. That's the separation from truth. That's the separation from nature. And I'm seeing now that the Census Bureau was launched on July 1, 1903, not 1913.
In 1837, Samuel Morse unveiled his electrical telegraph, which was a game-changing piece of technology that shrank the world by letting messages travel across vast distances near instantly. The telegraph system used electric pulses to send coded messages over wires. Samuel Morse, along with his assistant Alfred Vail, developed the dot-dash Morse code that is still known today. On January 6, 1838, Morse demoed his invention publicly, sending a message across 2 miles of wire in Morristown, New Jersey. 6 years later, in 1844, the first official message was sent, "What hath God wrought?" from Washington, D.C. to about 40 miles away in Baltimore, Maryland, proving that the system was capable of long-distance messaging. The telegraph was able to link cities and businesses, and eventually nation to nation. A message that once took days or weeks, or sometimes even months by horse or ship, could now arrive within minutes. Once it was implemented, the technology was also turned to surveillance use. During the American Civil War, which lasted from 1861 until 1865, the telegraph surveillance potential was realized, since both Union and Confederate forces relied on it to coordinate troops and relay orders. However, they also started intercepting each other's messages. The Union was said to be especially good at this, setting up telegraph stations to eavesdrop on Confederate lines. Operators would climb poles and splice into wires, decode the clicks, which turned the telegraph into a wartime spying tool. Ciphers were also developed to protect messages while going about cracking the other sides. The American Civil War showed how a tool that had been built for connection could be flipped into one for control. This idea would now permeate all future technologies.
One of the side effects of technology, and this doesn't seem much like technology to us these days, but it speeds up society. But isn't it interesting that the first message sent, they claim, is "What hath God wrought?" I guess I would mention that I don't think God wrought anything. That was an invention of a man. We are told his name was Samuel Morse. But the religious and spiritual experience was so ingrained with those cultures back then that not only was life being speeded up, but this is what's being separated away. As each decade follows, we get further and further and further away until we hit the 1960s, and then it just flips on a dime, and we are no longer close to the truths of nature. Our morality has been damaged. The family unit has been destroyed. And I think it's important to recognize that technology has been used to help this along for those who are interested in controlling basically large societies.
Stepping back to 1839, photography emerged as another significant technological advancement, being developed independently by Louis Daguerre in France, as well as William Henry Fox Talbot in England. Daguerre introduced the daguerreotype in January of that year, which was a process that utilized a chemically treated copper plate exposed to light that produced a single, highly detailed image without a negative. Concurrently, Talbot refined the calotype, which employed light-sensitive paper to create a negative that was capable of yielding multiple prints. These innovations were publicly disclosed in 1839, with Daguerre's being through the French government in August and Talbot's in September, which established photography as a tool for visual documentation. Initially, it was embraced for artistic and scientific purposes, but photography soon demonstrated much broader applications. By the 1850s, law enforcement agencies in Europe and the United States began utilizing photographs for identification, notably in the form of criminal portraits, or what we normally call mugshots. During the American Civil War, photography documented military personnel and captives, while private agencies, such as the infamous Pinkerton detectives, employed it to track suspects. The transition of photography from a medium of representation to an instrument of record keeping and monitoring was quite significant, setting things up on the path for what would become systematic observation and control.
Without a doubt, but can you imagine how magical this must have seemed to the people who first saw photography. I'm not sure if there's footage, but there's accounts of the first time moving pictures come in, and there's a shot of a train and people in the audience scream and jump out of the way. That's how far their mindset was away from the new technology emerging. They had not yet been able to separate that this is just an image in the core of their being. It's a train is coming. I've got to jump out of the way. But it's things like these that are tectonic shifts in the way culture is going to fashion. And as Jason points out, we could be out doing a lot of things with the images back then, but right away it's for criminals and for military use and other things.
In 1891, Thomas Edison, collaborating with his assistant William Kennedy Dixon, patented the kinetograph, an early motion picture camera that marked a significant advancement in visual recording technology. It built on Edison's prior work with the phonograph and Dixon's expertise in photographic processes, with the kinetograph utilizing a strip of perforated celluloid film advanced mechanically to capture sequential images at a rapid rate. Paired with the kinetoscope, which was a viewing device introduced in 1894, the new technology enabled the recording and playback of moving images, a feat that was publicly demonstrated with short films such as Monkey Shines No. 1. This invention shifted visual documentation from static photographs to dynamic sequences, which broadened the scope of what could be preserved and analyzed. It was initially developed for entertainment and commercial purposes, but the motion picture camera's potential extended far beyond its original intent. By enabling the continuous capture of events, it provided a means to observe and document most activities in real time. While its immediate use was limited to studios due to the early tech's size and complexity, the concept of moving images influenced subsequent innovations. Camera technology continuously evolved, and by the early 20th century, smaller, more portable cameras would come about.
There are accounts that there's a certain point where this kind of technology is considered very lowbrow, which must have been after the initial wow wore off, but that's what it was considered. But look what's come of this. One of the main ways social engineering is broadcast around the world is because of the movie camera and the ability to record voice.
In 1898, the U.S. occupation of the Philippines begins following its victory in the Spanish-American War, which was formalized on December 10, 1898, with the Treaty of Paris, with Spain ceding the Philippines to the United States for $20 million. Interestingly, this transfer ignored the Filipino Revolutionary Government, which had declared independence on June 12, 1898, after fighting Spain alongside U.S. forces. Facing resistance, the U.S. Army established a colonial surveillance system, which included the Division of Military Information, which used telegraphs, photography, and informant networks to monitor the population. This is arguably the world's first full-scale surveillance state in a colonial context. What followed was the Philippine-American War, which lasted from 1899 to 1902. This prompted the U.S. military to establish a sophisticated system of governance and control, including an extensive surveillance apparatus that was designed to suppress insurgency and manage the population. Central to this effort was the U.S. Army's Division of Military Information, the DMI, which was created in 1901 under the military government of the Philippines. The DMI functioned as an intelligence unit tasked with gathering and analyzing data on Filipino resistance movements. The DMI employed a multifaceted approach, integrating existing technologies and methods. They used telegraphs for rapid communication across the islands, photography for identification and documentation, and a network of local informants to infiltrate communities. Telegraphic lines, which were expanded from the Spanish infrastructure, enabled near-instantaneous relay of orders and reports between military outposts. Photography, which was already in use for criminal records elsewhere, was adapted to catalog suspected insurgents, their families, and villages, creating visual dossiers. Informants, who are often coerced or incentivized Filipinos, provided human intelligence, reporting on movements, gatherings, and sentiments within the population. The following Philippine-American War was quite horrific, and World War II made things even more complicated, with Japan conquering the area a few days after the attack on Pearl Harbor. After World War II, on July 4, 1946, the U.S. would formally recognize Philippine independence via the Treaty of Manila.
You know, all this searching for the era shift and always kind of being frustrated because I still don't feel like I have a date that I can just accept without doubt. But over and over, we see the late 1800s as a massive dividing line between the older world and what we're more familiar with in the new world, to include the early 1900s, the Rockefellerization, and all the things that we've covered. But I mean, don't you feel that way, Jason? Like there was literally almost an age shift at the very end of the 1800s, dividing the older world with what we do now?
Absolutely. And we especially see it with the way science is approached.
Yes.
I really think we seem to be going one direction with trying to understand how the universe actually works. And then once you get into the 20th century, something, and we know what that might be and probably was, skewed it away from what was going on to what we have now.
I agree. And there's a cover-up that seems to occur within the 1800s before the dividing line in the late century there. And to me, it appears like when we look at things like the beauty and everything that was made, so ornate and so passionately built, it seems that the sciences had already started to boom, but those sciences were more in step with nature. And then at the late 1800s, all of that and knowledge of all of that begins to be erased, where the new, cleaved away from natural concerned sciences are going to be in the forefront.
In 1900, American cities began widely adopting the Gamewell Corporation's telegraphic systems. These were a network of call boxes and alarms that connected police and fire departments to central stations. This innovation transformed urban emergency response, with over 41 million messages said to be sent annually by the early 20th century. The success of these systems demonstrated that a major city could be mass connected via technology, which laid the groundwork for later installations. The Gamewell Corporation, which had been founded in 1855, was also a private firm that sold its systems to cities and were profiting from public safety needs. Municipalities depended on its patents and maintenance, which blurred the lines between state and corporate interests. This could be thought of as an example of the military-industrial complex, as well as an early example of how things might be done with the surveillance state.
I agree wholeheartedly. And this is a big deal because the idea of government, even when I was young, was supposed to be, well, they're above everyone. But the truth is, the corporations have had sway for a very long time. And when you look at the tally Jason just laid down, 41 million messages sent in 1900, it's almost like anything that becomes successful becomes subsumed under the military-industrial complex, whether we know about it or not.
Moving up to 1917, the United States enters into World War I, or the Great War, as it was known at the time. This marked a pivotal moment, not just for worldwide conflict on an unbelievable scale never seen before, but also for the birth of modern domestic surveillance. Colonel Ralph Van Diemen, a career officer with experience in the Philippines, saw intelligence as the future of warfare and was nicknamed the father of American military intelligence. Because of this, he created the Military Intelligence Division, the MID, and the American Protective League, APL, the latter of which was a sprawling civilian spy network that turned paranoia into policy. It would amass over 1 million pages of reports on German Americans in just 14 months. The APL was conceived of in March of 1917 and ballooned to 350,000 members across 1,200 chapters by 1918, per its own records. Recruits for the organization included bankers, lawyers, and factory workers, all of which were ordinary citizens who turned into amateur sleuths. They would spy on neighbors, infiltrate unions, and would raid homes, often without warrants. Their targets were German Americans, pacifists, socialists, and anyone un-American. APL operatives tapped phones, opened mail, and staged loyalty tests, for example, pressuring people into buying war bonds. During slacker raids in 1918, they rounded up 50,000 men in New York and Chicago to check their draft status, with most being innocent. The APL operated with tacit government approval, but had little official oversight. Its files, which were brimming with gossip and innuendo, fed into the MID's growing database. The MID had been started in May of 1917 when Colonel Van Diemen had convinced the War Department to establish the Military Intelligence Division within the General Staff. It started out very small with only 17 officers. However, it is said to have grown to over 1,600 personnel by the end of the war, per the Army's records. The MID focused on espionage and counterintelligence, both abroad and in the United States. It tracked German agents, monitored mail, and cracked codes, but its domestic gaze was considered sharper. Van Diemen built a filing system that consisted of hundreds of thousands of index cards that cross-referenced suspects based on tips, rumors, and intercepted letters. The APL disbanded in 1919, but the MID endured, morphing into the Military Intelligence Service. Its tactics influenced the Red Scare of 1919 and 1920, when the Bureau of Investigation, under the rule of J. Edgar Hoover, targeted radicals using similar files and informant networks. The MID and APL turned a war emergency into a surveillance template, acting as a blueprint for what would come later.
This is a key paragraph that Jason just read. World War One, even for me, it's like beyond my common sense view that I feel like I have a little bit through my grandparents and parents into World War One. But people like Rudolf Steiner, if you read some of those books, make a big, big deal out of what World War One meant and the change that it brought with it. Fortune has gone on endlessly with me in private conversations, trying to instill the massive change of World War One and the fact that it was started intentionally, which most people are not. It's just another false flag, kind of, sort of, but that's how it started, by intention. Now, when you follow this through, what you're seeing is that the rights of human beings are being thrown by the wayside with the support of the people in charge. And I mean, words have meaning. It's no coincidence, I'm sure, that the man who starts all this military intelligence, his name is Diemen, just to make a side note. But World War One was a massive, massive change point. And again, here we are right around that dividing line of the end of the 1800s, almost to the point where one would wonder, could people have been treated in this manner in the middle of the 1800s. Point is, World War One comes and the shift about what rights are and how people are treated changes a lot.
World War One was over in November of 1918. After this, between 1918 and 1920, the U.S. government turned its wartime surveillance machinery to targeting the American left in a campaign of mass arrests and deportations that are known as the Palmer Raids. These were spearheaded by Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer and his young protege, J. Edgar Hoover. These raids relied heavily on intelligence information that had been gathered by the Military Intelligence Division and the Bureau of Investigation, the BOI, which would later become the FBI. This period, which has been dubbed the First Red Scare, marked a pivotal escalation in domestic surveillance. BOI agents, often with MID support, would raid homes, meeting halls, and workplaces in over 30 cities. Over 10,000 people were arrested, per Justice Department estimates, although the exact figures vary due to poor record keeping. The raids focused on immigrant radicals, especially those with ties to the Union of Russian Workers, Communist Party USA, and Industrial Workers of the World. About 550 people were deported in total. The raids were often warrantless, relying on vague membership in radical groups as grounds for arrest under the 1918 Immigration Act. Detainees were said to face brutal conditions, with reports of beatings and starvation in overcrowded jails. The raid's speed and scale were possible only because of the pre-existing wartime data. MID's wartime monitoring of German sympathizers had morphed into tracking Reds, while Hoover's General Intelligence Division, the GID, compiled dossiers on 60,000 individuals by mid-1920, per his own reports to Congress. This included not just activists, but sympathizers, journalists, and even elected officials. The Palmer raids turned wartime surveillance into a domestic weapon, proving that the state could monitor, catalog, and repress at scale. The MID's files and Hoover's GID could be said to be the surveillance state's first gears. Palmer and Hoover had weaponized fear of bombs and Reds to justify overreach, with public support waning only when abuses became undeniable.
And there it is. All this has to be done out of the view of the general public. When it becomes undeniable, they have to backpedal, change, hide. But who are we talking about here? J. Edgar Hoover. It's almost like they have to find a perverted being to fill such positions, because the accounts we get of this man for his time and the way he conducted himself and the things he did in his leisure time were completely unacceptable to the culture of that time. So how is it that we ignore the link? We see this today in those special, very rich people with the weird things we hear about, the disturbing parties and other things that are coming to a head now. How is it that all these people with power have this not normal thing going on in their life as compared to the general population? And I would submit to you that when terrible things are going to be done, they're going to put a terrible person in charge of that. At least that's the way I see it.
I think we find out later on that J. Edgar Hoover was quite an interesting and deviant individual.
Particularly for the culture of his time, it had to be hidden without a shred getting out. The population at that time still had some moral value. The family unit was still intact. And there was a spiritual tendency at the base of most things done in this country.
In May of 1919, the U.S. launched the Black Chamber, which was officially known as MI8 or the Cipher Bureau. This marked the country's first formal peacetime effort to decrypt foreign communications. Established shortly after World War I by Herbert O. Yardley, who was a former wartime codebreaker in the Military Intelligence Division, it was jointly funded by the War and State Departments, which reflected a shift from wartime necessity to peacetime strategy. The unit was housed covertly in a New York City residential building commonly known as Brownstones, and operated under the guise of a commercial code company to mask its true purpose. Its primary goal was to intercept and decrypt foreign diplomatic and commercial communications, and focused on cables that were sent via telegraph companies like Postal Telegraph and Western Union. The Black Chamber relied on cooperation from telegraph companies, which provided copies of cables under secret agreements. This was technically legal at the time, as U.S. law didn't protect foreign communications, although it certainly raised ethical questions. Yardley's team broke codes from over 20 countries, which included Britain, Germany, Mexico, and Japan. Their biggest coup was decrypting Japanese diplomatic cables during the 1921-1922 Washington Naval Conference, which revealed Tokyo's negotiating strategy which helped the U.S. secure favorable arms limits. By the mid-1920s, the unit was processing thousands of messages monthly and employed about 20 cryptanalysts. The Black Chamber operated in strict secrecy, with no public or congressional oversight. Only a handful of officials even knew of its existence. The Black Chamber was shut down abruptly in October of 1929, a victim of changing political winds and Yardley's own actions. Newly appointed Secretary of State Henry Stimson, upon learning of the program's existence, was appalled and famously declared, "Gentlemen, do not read each other's mail." He cut State Department funding, which forced closure, as the War Department couldn't sustain it alone. Yardley, now out of a job and being quite annoyed with the situation, published The American Black Chamber in 1931, a best-selling exposé that detailed the unit's operations, including the Japanese cable coup.
And this was a long time ago. And what happens? You get a guy that actually has some value in the rules and the law, and he shuts it down. But what we see here is that these big corporations, the telecoms, the airlines, is a prime example. There's never been a time when they weren't in bed. And this is the connection to Hollywood. If you do detailed research on the connections between Hollywood and the so-called American government, you will be astonished. It's almost like they were never separate. There were times when they appeared to be at odds, but the point I'm making is the connection between big corporations that have technology of some kind and the government and the industrial complex, it's been hand in hand under the table for a very, very long time.
So that's going to bring us to the top of hour one. I have to say, when I was going through all of this research, I had no idea how in-depth and how, I don't even know what word to use, just how almost sinister a lot of stuff was going on all the way back in the 1800s and 1900s. There are things going on that very much reminded me of the post-9/11 time.
It's unbelievable. And the more we look back at these things and see people like J. Edgar Hoover and others, it's like there is a subset of humanity, for whatever reason, that have no qualms about being horrible people. And they have no problem with hiding it. They have no problem with killing. They have no problem with any of the things I feel the majority of us would draw the line on. And this is a story that goes back Lord knows how long. It's incredible. Anyhow, I'm going to wrap up for hour one. Anything more you want to add?
Well, as you can see, we're only into the 1920s, and my goodness, the amount of stuff that was going on that the general public might not even really been thinking about really, as I said, quite astounded me. And you think it's going to get any better? Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. It's going to get much, much worse as the decades roll by.
Well, let me put a little spin on that. It is my point of view that at some point in the future, as we move into a lifted consciousness era and a higher vibrational era, that things like this will just have to not exist, whether they're intentionally taken down or they crumble under their own weight. How long that is, I don't know. I mean, I'm with Jason. There are times when I think, God, are we going to do this for 100 years? How long is this going to be? But I am certain that in the coming era, the low vibrational systems that are being torn down intentionally in front of your face right now are all going to be gone. How long that is, Lord only knows. But I'm going to wrap up hour one. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is CROW777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and members get access to everything. The comments, the forums, the ability to create top-level topics. They can stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime they like. That covers all my older telescope work, lunar waves, chemtrails, a litany of bizarre objects, the first filming of the second sun, which will be an emerging big deal in this era, according to me. And lastly, the images that I have shot with my solar rig are available as well. Some of them, I have left evidence of the second sun behind the sun we see, just so you know what to look for if you're going to get some of those. Anyhow, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back for hour two of episode 623. and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.